Hello there, you're with Extra with me, Geraldine Doogue, bringing you just some of the people and the stories that excite me each week. So great to have your company for the next half hour. Well, now to the power of mercy. It's quite a story. In 1993, a young Norman Brown was told he would die behind bars in the United States. He'd been sentenced to life in prison without parole for distributing crack cocaine in Washington, D.C. 24 years later, after a spotless record of behaviour and good achievements, Norman Brown received a phone call letting him know he'd been granted clemency by the President of the US, Barack Obama. He was to be a free man. And Norman's release from prison is part of a move by the president and many in the justice sector to correct the draconian sentences handed out to non-violent drug offenders under so-called Get Tough laws introduced in the 1980s that have since been revised. To date, President Obama has granted over 600 commutations, decisions that embody his belief that America is a nation of second chances. Now, to tell us more, I'm joined by Cynthia Roseberry. She leads Clemency Project 2014. It's a group that gives pro bono assistance to prisoners who wish to apply for clemency. And Norman Brown is with us too in Washington. A very warm welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Now, Norman, I have to hear your story first. How did you end up with a life sentence for a drug offense?
In 1987, there was a mandatory minimum bill passed. And what had happened in 1990, I was convicted of a conspiracy to sell crack cocaine. When I went to trial, I was in trial for 4.5 months. And at the end of the trial, I ended up beating all of the conspiracy charges, and I was found guilty of one of the laws. And by me being found guilty of that law, it put me in a situation or a mandatory minimum of life without parole.
Because there are a couple of things that must be said. You'd had one offense, hadn't you, in 1987, when you were still a teenager, of a small amount of powder cocaine to an undercover police officer. And then in 1990, I think the FBI recorded you telling a co-defendant whose car had been found with a pound of cocaine inside to call the police and say the car had been stolen while you were playing basketball. So this is the background, just to let listeners know exactly, you know, what were the conditions?
Okay, yes, you're right and exact. What had happened was in 1987, I had served the undercover police officer about $50 worth of powder cocaine. I ended up going to trial on that in 1988, and I was found not guilty the first time, and they retried me and found me guilty on 2 counts. So in 1990, when I was indicted along with 20 co-defendants, what had happened was once I ended up winning the majority of those charges and I got found guilty on strictly distribution, what had happened was they said that by me being convicted of those 2 small amounts of cocaine in 1987, then what that did is set me up to become what they call a 3-time loser.
Yes, and at the time, even the judge, I read, said, this is too harsh, but my hands are tied. And you were in your 20s when you went to prison. I mean, how did you cope with the prospect of being there for the rest of your life?
I think what I ended up doing was really not trying to focus on the sentence so much because, to be honest with you, I never really, really, really accepted the life without parole sentence in my psyche. And by not accepting it, it always kept me afloat with hoping that someday the laws are made to be changed. And with that type of mindset, I ended up holding on. But at the same time, I made a whole lot of changes in my life to become better. And each year I began to get better and better, which gave me more hope that one day I would be free.
So you never despaired, didn't you?
No, I didn't. I couldn't afford to.
Cynthia, the sentencing laws under which Norman was convicted, now they have been changed, is that right?
Many of them have. Some of the mandatory minimum laws have not changed, though. Norman mentioned the 100-to-1 ratio for powder and crack cocaine, and the Sentencing Commission has acted to reduce that ratio to 18-to-1. So you have to have 18 times as much powder cocaine as you would crack cocaine to get a certain sentence. But there are still mandatory minimums. We still have what we call career offenders, which is someone who may have been convicted of two other prior offenses and then faces a third offense in the federal system. But our attitudes are changing, surely.
Getting back more to the old British civil law notion, the punishment must fit the crime.
Exactly. We've for too long not looked at individuals, which by law we're charged with doing. And we've only looked at the crime and sort of the case number. And so now we're finally coming back around to say we need to make individualized assessments and hand out sentences that are proportionate to the offense and the person who committed the offense.
Could you tell me, please, about this clemency process that's happening? Clemency is such a lovely word, but we don't hear it used very much, certainly not here in Australia.
Sure. So it is an Article 2 power of the president and has been used over the history of America. It's not been used as broadly by as many presidents, and certainly not in the same way that President Obama has used it. Most people know about the pardon power, and the pardon power is lock and step with the clemency authority. Pardon being to forgive the sin, and clemency being to reduce the sentence so that the sin is not quite so bad.
And so what are the yardsticks by which you can apply for clemency?
So under this initiative, they have to be someone who's committed a federal offense. They have to have served 10 years in prison. The offense has to be a nonviolent offense. They can't have any gang affiliation, can't be a leader. And the gravamen of the legal analysis is that the sentence, if given today, would be a lower sentence than the one they originally received.
And presumably good conduct in prison has to come into it?
Yes, thank you. They have to have a nonviolent history, both outside of prison and during their time in prison.
And you lead this project, Clemency Project 2014, coordinating all the lawyers who are offering free legal help, I understand, to prisoners.
That's correct. We think it's an historic pro bono effort by the bar. Someone said to me the other day, you manage the largest law firm in America. We have over 4,000 lawyers, and we've had more than 36,000 applicants.
Wow, Cynthia, that is an incredibly good reflection on the U.S., isn't it?
It absolutely is. You know, you might not be familiar with many of the lawyer jokes that we hear in the U.S., but this certainly is redemption for us, clemency, if you will, for lawyers.
Yes.
Who have stood up and said, I'm going to help someone who may never know my name, but I'm going to offer to help them.
I'll just let listeners know, we're talking about President Obama granting clemency to a record number of prisoners in the US. And joining us now from Washington to tell us this story is Norman Brown. He's a free man after serving 24 years of a life sentence that under current laws would not be possible. And Cynthia Roseberry is the project manager for Clemency 2014, which we've just been discussing there. Now, Norman, you know about this firsthand. Could I ask you, please, what it was like when you received that message from your president that your application for clemency had been approved?
Yes, I'm still trying to gather my feet and my legs up under me because I was a complete mess because I had been rejected through the regular penal system in the court system for so long that for my unit team, which is what we call a team that works with us while we're incarcerated, and my lawyers to call me to the office up out of the clear blue sky and say, are you ready for this information? I said, well, what is it? I thought it was another rejection. So they came back and they said, well, President Obama has accepted your clemency. So I stopped and I said, well, what does that mean? And they said, you have a new release date of November. Now, mind you, this was in July when they told me this. And I said, well, November of what year? And they said, November of 2015. And I stayed there in shock and awe. And I was so excited I couldn't shed a tear But to just get your life back so fast is so stunning and somewhat remarkable. And I'm still now trying to get my balance after about 13 months being a free man.
I'll bet you are. Norman, what sort of person got caught up in these tough laws?
Yes, when you come down to, especially that are falling up under the crack cocaine law, if it's not just the majority of black, it's Hispanics, and what they would say of people of hue. And what is happening is that there are a large amount of people that are coming up in what you would call low-income housing and things of this nature. But there's also those of us who may be also involved in that that were not coming out of low-income housing, because it almost became a trend of just more of people who were just seeing and involving themselves in something that really didn't have an idea, like myself, of what we were getting ourselves into.
Mm. Cynthia, is there a bipartisan recognition now that this redress that you described was needed?
I think we're starting to see people from all along the political spectrum agree that we need criminal justice reform. We've had some legislative proposals that have been floating around that we're hopeful will be passed, but we're in the waning days, of course, of this administration. But by and large, I think you've seen, both at the federal level and in individual states, an effort that is bipartisan to make our sentencing and our criminal justice system more just and less criminal.
I have read that some people believe the whole process, while admirable, is going far too slowly, that there needs to be a faster mechanism to address the problem of unfair sentencing generally. Is that a fair criticism?
I think in some instances it can be, but I'll give you this example. 10 years ago, and 10 years is the minimum amount of time you have to have served to be eligible for our program, the iPod, the Bluetooth earphone, and the PlayStation were just being released. And so to take someone from an environment where they weren't even familiar with that technology, for example, and to place them back into society without any help for reentry is almost like placing an alien on a different planet. Norman now is working with people to help them adjust to reentering. So we could move more swiftly to give people access to being released. But I think it's important not to just shove people back out into society after they've been away for so long.
So you, if you had to, where you want to divide up the energies, by the sound of you, it's the aftermath as much as getting them out of prison, which is interesting to hear your emphasis.
Absolutely. They need to be supported. You know, we say go and get a job. And if they have, for example, no computer skills, even at a McDonald's in the U.S., you have to use an iPad to apply. Right. And so it's not as simple as going to get a job.
Quite. I mean, Barack Obama recently addressed black voters specifically, and he urged them, we noticed, to vote Democrat to defend his legacy. And he mentioned working to end mass incarceration. What's he aiming for? What further changes is he aiming at?
Well, I think he's supporting some of the other legislation. I think he's frankly trying to change the narrative around redemption. We have for too long put human beings in cages because we're angry with them, as opposed to because we want to correct them. And I think what he's showing us is that redemption should be a normal part of our system. We should embrace those who are returning, and we should say, your ticket is stamped in full. You have a receipt. You've paid your debt to society.
Did you feel that like that, Norman? You clearly had this marvelous temperamental approach to your plight, but do you come out a thoroughly different man, having feel that you have paid a debt and more for your offences, such as they were?
Yes. I grew up while I was incarcerated because what I did was I used it as a university of higher learning. Because what it is that if you don't, you will allow prison to turn in on you, and you will become what you would call a product of the environment. So what I did was I took very good care of trying to make sure that I did not let frustration and what I saw as a form of injustice based upon this draconian sentencing to cause me to grow angry. So what I did was I took a lot of classes, and then I began to teach a lot of classes so that I could stay busy, so that I could stay growing up, and so that I could come out a better and a more intelligent man.
Gee, how you kept the anger at bay must have been a challenge. I believe you actually got to meet Barack Obama too.
Oh, yes, I did. I had the honors of having lunch with him.
With a group or with just you two?
No, it was about five. I think it was five of us who were invited to the White House, and we didn't even know that President Obama was going to come in. And what had happened when we were in there being interviewed, he came through the Oval Office door and said he just so happened to have some open space in his schedule for the day, and he wanted to invite us out to lunch.
That must have been pretty special.
Yes, that was jaw-dropping for me because I did not see that one coming.
And look, you know, what's it like getting into this world of computers, seeing your family again, just getting back to, quotes, normal life?
I often always think about making sure that I kept the whole me balanced and not just try to focus on the fact that you have to have a job, the fact that you need someone to live. These are very important assets to have. But what I want to make sure that I deal with the whole man, the whole makeup of myself, because to come out after having to adjust to maybe making just $70 a month and to go inside of some stores and grocery stores and go in and pick up four or five items that may end up being $70 is a psychological adjustment that you have to make in itself. Also, you have to come out now, and when you're used to being incarcerated in your own space, but when you have a mate that you now inviting into your space, you have to learn how to share. So all of these things are part of a transition that you have to pay very close attention to, because if not, you can become very imbalanced and you can sometimes trip up over your own feet.
Oh, well, look, it's been a privilege to talk to both of you. Norman, I genuinely wish you all the very best in this land of second chances. Thank you very much for your time and good luck.
Thank you very much for having me on, and it was such an honour to be able to have this opportunity.
And Cynthia Roseberry, look, you know, more power to your arm, coordinating that army of pro bono attorneys at the Clemency Project. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you for having us.
On RN, you're listening to Extra, the best of Saturday's show, with me, Geraldine Duke. RN is devoting this coming month to a project we're calling Reboot Your Life. It's designed to reach right into the lives of all of us, listeners and radio workers alike, and to acknowledge that lots of the givens are shifting about our lives, and many of us might need to be brought up to date with some of the thinking about what does promote well-being or wellness these days, in itself quite a new emphasis. Indeed, sleep has been elevated in modern society from something we all did and hardly thought about to a multi-billion dollar industry founded on self-help books, fancy pyjamas, scented sprays, expensive retreats. I mean, we all know we need sleep, although exactly how much we should be getting is the subject of endless arguments among sleep scientists. But where exactly is this obsession with slumber taking us? Is the so-called sleep revolution, led by sleep evangelists like Arianna Huffington, the media mogul, is it likely to produce more rest for us? Well, Sophie McBain is a contributing writer for the New Statesman, and she weighed in recently with an interesting and contrarian piece for the magazine about who should really be worried about this and who shouldn't. Prepare to be a little bit shocked, maybe I should say, listeners, by the notion of class entering the debate. Welcome to Saturday Extra.
Hi.
Can I ask you a personal question? How do you sleep?
I think generally my sleep patterns are not too bad. I have had kind of short periods of insomnia in my life, and they were so stressful. And so I do really feel for people who have ongoing sleep problems and have things like insomnia.
Your article basically said that we're developing an obsession with sleep, and you really started to research it. I mean, it used to be that sleep was a bit uncool. We were all trying to fit in with the work hard, play hard mentality. Now we're spritzing lavender all around the bedroom and buying these self-help guides. What's going on?
I think there is a lot of anxiety about sleep. For instance, there was a survey in 2011 in the UK, and two-thirds of respondents said that they had some kind of sleep problem, which made me wonder how much it really is a problem and how much it's a matter of our anxiety and our expectations about how well we're sleeping. And that's probably partly because of the increased interest in health and well-being, and maybe also because we're understanding the science of sleep a bit better. And it is true that if you're not getting good enough sleep, it can affect your health in all kinds of ways. So I think it's a variety of factors.
Yeah, you said, if I read you correctly, that actually this so-called sleep revolution was aimed at the people who do already sleep relatively well, affluent white-collar workers. And oddly enough, we all thought that was the group getting the least sleep. That's what's usually reported in the media. Have we been getting it wrong?
I think there are, of course, lots of stressed out white collar workers who aren't getting enough sleep. But if you look generally across that group, it seems they're getting healthier sleep patterns. And this is something that was first picked up by a podcast called Freakonomics. And they, lots of the time when people do surveys across large groups of people, they look at the average hours that different groups sleep. But in actual fact, getting too much sleep is almost worse for you than getting too little sleep. And so you find that, in fact, people who are poor, have low social economic status, are more likely to either sleep far too little or far too much for their well-being. And that often gets lost in the data. So we've had this mistaken notion that people who are wealthier and higher educated and in high-powered professional jobs have the least healthy sleep patterns, and they probably don't.
So what the implication is that people who sleep too long have got underlying issues, psychological issues like depression or post-traumatic stress, or they're not adjusting to new environments, something like that.
Yeah, so it's not that sleeping for too long is likely to be harmful in itself, but quite often it could be something like depression, or it could be that there's an underlying undiagnosed or perhaps diagnosed chronic illness. Someone has cancer or some other kind of long-term illness, that probably means that they're going to be sleeping longer.
And typically they haven't gone to get that diagnosed.
Yeah, or perhaps they have. So the study that this is based on was done in the University of Warwick in the UK, and it looked at the sleep patterns of 1 million people, and it found that when they looked at the study period, if you sleep less than 6 hours, you're 12% more likely to die within the study period than people who sleep between 6 and 8 hours. But if you sleep more than 8 hours a night, then you're 30% more likely to die in that period.
30%?
But that's not something to kind of then get terrified about if you happen to sleep 9 hours a night on average, because there could be all kinds of other reasons, and that in itself isn't bad for you. The sleeping part isn't what's damaging your health, unlike sleeping too little.
I noticed you also quoted the American Time Use Survey, which analysed the lifestyle patterns of 150,000 people in the US. Now, what did it show?
What it showed is that if you are a Black American, if you have a lower level of education, and if you have a low socioeconomic status, then you're more likely to kind of fall on the wrong ends of this U-curve in terms of your sleep and your health. You're more likely to sleep too little, less than 6 hours a night, or far too much, so more than 8 hours a night.
That's the class element that I'm talking about. I mean, that's what I got from your piece anyway, that the worried well are worrying about this, but it may well be that there's a whole lot of other people who haven't thought that they've bought into the sleep obsession who actually have got more cause to be concerned.
Yeah, I think that's really true. I think the modern kind of sleep self-help writers have diagnosed the problem correctly. They know that if you don't sleep enough, that it's not good for your health, but they're then aiming it at the wrong audience. And it's a little bit like if you think that tackling global malnutrition, you should look at wellness bloggers, because wellness bloggers quite clearly position themselves to people who have quite large disposable incomes, who probably already eat quite healthily, but who are willing to give chia seeds a go. And similarly, these new sleep evangelists are aiming towards people who are already quite health conscious, who feel like they're really stressed out in their jobs, and who want to have a few easy fixes to make it easier for them to sleep. Because I think probably the people who have the worst sleep patterns, it's not really a choice for them. Their problems aren't going to be solved by buying new pyjamas or a lavender spray.
I came across an article titled How to Sleep Like a Hunter-Gatherer in Discover magazine. And we do entertain this notion that people in societies that are less developed sleep so much better because they don't have electric light disrupting our bodies. What did you find the science thought about this?
It's really hard to measure because people didn't really record in much detail how much they were sleeping before electric light came into play. But there was one study in 2015, and it looked at the sleeping patterns of traditional communities in Namibia, Bolivia, and Tanzania. And it gave them smartwatches to look at how much they slept. And the study also thought that perhaps they sleep more than we do because they don't have electric light disturbing their sleep patterns. And in actual fact, they tend to just sleep exactly the same as most people in advanced industrial societies. So it's between about 6.9 and 8.5 hours sleep a night. So that also made me wonder whether we've developed this real cultural idea that our sleep patterns changed a huge amount after the Industrial Revolution and the invention of electric light, and maybe they didn't actually change that much.
Very interesting. I mean, you fundamentally, I think, do say that we in the West worry now a lot about what's going to happen to us if we don't get our 7 or 8 hours of kip. But this becomes part of the problem, that people are told, relax, don't worry too much about sleep. And that actually doesn't help people who have bought into, having been inculcated, in fact, with the notion that they won't be either productive or serene or happy if they have poor sleep.
Yeah, I think that's true. And there are a couple of surveys that show that, in fact, if you're really anxious about your sleep, you're more likely to think that you're getting less of it than you actually are. And lots of people who are quite relaxed about their sleep patterns actually sleep slightly less than they think they do. But because they're not up at night worrying about why they're not asleep yet and if they're comfortable, they don't remember all that time they spend in bed kind of thinking and waiting to fall asleep.
What was your take out then? I mean, did you change your own behaviour or worry patterns as a result of doing this bit of research?
Well, this is going to sound really weird given everything I've said, but after kind of reading all these endless studies and self-help books, I did stop doing things that I was doing before that were quite unhealthy. So I tried to stop checking my phone in bed and watching TV right before I went to bed or checking my emails. And I guess I spent quite a lot more time thinking about my sleep patterns than I really had before. I don't think any of this does any harm. If you're reading a sleep self-help book and you decide to cut down on alcohol and have a hot milky drink at night or not check your phone in bed, all these small fixes, I don't think that's harmful. In fact, you might suddenly find that you sleep much better than you ever did, and that's great. And I think it's as long as people don't feel that that's the whole sleep problem, when really there's this kind of big economic problem, the big reason why lots of people aren't going to don't get enough sleep, and their health is really suffering, and that's because of much bigger, more structural problems in the way society works at the moment.
Well, look, thank you very much indeed, Sophie. Mercifully, I haven't had a lot of sleep problems. I feel immensely sorry for people who do, but I can see that you've contributed to the discussion. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
I'm Geraldine Doogue. I do hope you can join me at the same time next week or online via the RN website.